From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. My guest this hour has been called an evolutionary engineer. And with the tools at hand today, that does not sound like an exaggeration. Gene editing is a very busy frontier right now. To fight disease, to secure crops, Kevin Esvelt says it is going to raise great public questions and soon about how and how much we want to change the world and ourselves. This hour On Point, changing the software of nature. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What should we, what will we do with this power? Joining me now in the studio is Kevin Esvelt, fellow at Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard Medical School, a prominent young evolutionary biologist and engineer who works on gene drives. He was the first to demonstrate how gene drives and CRISPR, the gene editing technology, could combine to alter fundamental traits of wild populations. Kevin Esvelt, welcome to On Point. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for inviting me.
I heard you talking recently at a 30th anniversary celebration for the MIT Media Lab. And there was a lot you said that got people's attention, got my attention. But one of the things that really struck me was, and I wonder if we can kind of start there to set out a framework and then back up to where things are now. But I believe you said that in seven generations, the human species may not be recognizable, that we are headed into a realm of genetic powers, manipulation that may change things in a way that is beyond our, would be beyond our recognition today. What do you mean by that?
Given the current trajectory of advancement, not just in genetic technologies, but also in interface, IT, and many other abilities to alter the way that we perceive reality, it's not ridiculous to imagine that we will want to improve ourselves, and especially our children, in ways that will, say, make us more like angels.
What do you mean by that?
So Steven Pinker also gave a talk at the Media Lab's 30th anniversary about his book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, about how violence is declining. And you can imagine that while our improvements to date are largely the result of culture, one can also imagine that we could rewrite ourselves and our children to make us better people.
Rewrite, and what you're talking about is about rewriting our genetic code.
That's right. So nature operates in DNA. You might say that nature's operating system, nature communicates in the language of DNA. Mm-hmm. And recent advances in biology mean that we are now learning to speak that language and to some extent can then speak back to nature.
Does that make DNA the software of nature? We sort of ran with that metaphor. Is that a fair characterization?
In a way. It's also interesting because it's the blueprints for the hardware as well. So it's a sort of a dual role molecule. But yes, very much so. It is a digital code that can be rewritten.
Are we on a path to rewriting that code in the same way that we've seen software rewritten now for generations?
We are. However, there's a noteworthy difference, and that is that the genetic code was written not by us, but by evolution. And just as in software development, you can get what's called spaghetti code, that is code that's been written and rewritten by so many designers that it's very hard to tell what it does. Mm-hmm. Almost all of natural DNA is something approximating spaghetti code because it was not designed and written by humans. It evolved. And that means that working with it requires understanding the different rules under which it operates.
Do people in your field anticipate a eventual human mastery of that software of nature, that genetic code, or will it always remain a mystery?
I'm always hesitant to say that anything will always remain a mystery. Right now, though, it's probably fair to say that we are two-year-olds. That is, we are just beginning to understand how things work. But we've also learned that we can harness evolution and use its rules in order to rewrite the code more effectively because it was written using evolution. And so if you can use evolution in turn to rewrite it yourself, you're using the same framework, the same compiler, to use a computer metaphor.
Mm-hmm. So we're two-year-olds in all of that now, though it can seem these days, like if we're like two-year-olds, we're making new discoveries every day. And yet you say in seven generations, which you say, you know, let's say 175 years, you've said with this power in hand, we will either have blown everything up and crashed civilization.
Let's hope not.
Let's hope not, of course. Or we will have recreated ourselves to become, again, the word you use basically, angels. That seems to be presuming some element of mastery or certainly a deep intervention in this spaghetti code.
Yes, and the challenge is we have now gained the tools with which to rewrite it, and that is CRISPR, which has given us unprecedented ability to edit just about any gene in just about any species. Mm-hmm. That is, if we can get DNA and CRISPR into a cell, then we can use that to rewrite the code of any gene in that cell.
And that's going on now.
It's been going on since the beginning of 2013,
mm-hmm.
and it has allowed not just specialist labs, but most laboratories to rewrite the code of whatever organism or cell line that they're working with.
For example, just last week in London, we saw this little girl, was it a one-year-old, leukemia, and they used CRISPR to go in, snip, change her genetic code, and I don't know if she's cured or not, but the cancer is in remission.
So in that case, they didn't use CRISPR. They used earlier technology called TALENs. But yes, it's mm-hmm. also, in effect, a pair of DNA cutting scissors mm-hmm. that they use to specifically edit the recognition molecules that determine an immune response. So they reprogrammed it mm-hmm. to recognize her tumor cells, the leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they introduced these new cells back into her body, they sought out and destroyed all of the tumor cells. And so that's why she's in remission. Hopefully they are all gone. Now, as a side effect, it also killed all of her non-tumor B cells. So she will need a bone marrow transplant.
Mm-hmm.
But that is standard for leukemia anyway. And what's novel here is that they reprogrammed these immune cells to seek out and destroy all of the tumor cells.
So there's reprogramming to save a very young girl from the leukemia, and it's in remission. We hope that works. Give us some examples of the kind of capacity. That's a capacity exercised, you know, the news just came out last week. The kind of capacities that we'd like to see in the next 10 years, 20 years, even longer in this seven-generation scenario of yours that are going to require some rather deep contemplation about how much we want to intervene.
Very much so. So what we've been talking about so far is what we call somatic gene therapy. That is altering the cells of existing humans of our bodies, but in a way that will not affect our children.
Mm-hmm.
This has many fewer ethical implications because it will not affect anyone other than the patient. So really, this is standard medicine, standard mm-hmm. medical ethics applies. There really are not too many fundamental questions going on here.
Because it's just for you, the patient, it's a treatment, it applies to only you.
Exactly. And while you can imagine that eventually there will be potentially enhancement someday, maybe, you can imagine we might use this rewriting to reprogram our neurons to grow again, to become more plastic, like children, so that we can learn more readily. That's one direction that we might go in terms of the 10 to 20 years timeline.
But that would still fall within the realm of just dealing with you one by one. That's
exactly.
A pretty big deal in itself. I want to bookmark that and come back to it. I want to learn French. I just go down and get a treatment. I don't know. I don't know what it would mean. We'll come back to that. But that's somatic gene therapy, as you say. But there's a more consequential kind of gene therapy, which would become what part of the code of all one's descendants.
That's right. Now, it's important to keep in mind that whenever we're talking about rewriting the code that constitutes our descendants, germline gene therapy, there is the question of what will the impact be on our children. And here is where safety is the paramount ethical concern. If this is not safe, then it would be highly unethical to pursue it. And right now, CRISPR is not safe enough to try that. So there have been a number of prominent calls led by the scientists who developed CRISPR, especially Jennifer Doudna, mm-hmm. who was one of the pioneers.
At Berkeley.
That's right, at Berkeley. And they said the technology is not mature enough, it's not specific enough, and we don't know enough about human development to use it safely to edit children. And to date, scientists have held by that. There have been no efforts to edit a future human life.
And yet, I heard you outline just a few days ago how it could be used to make heritable characteristics in the wild.
And that's a different ethical challenge, because whereas altering future generations, we have to think about the effects on those future generations, and to a lesser extent,
whether human or mice or mosquito or you name it.
But when we're talking about altering wild organisms, we're talking about altering the ecosystem. That is, we're talking about speaking the language of nature so as to change the ecosystem in ways that help humanity or in ways that might help the ecosystem.
For example, you talk a lot about going after Lyme disease. That would require getting to the genetic code of mice.
So mice are the primary reservoir of the bacterium that causes Lyme disease here in the Northeast. So the approach that I outlined, and I threw this out there because we have not begun experiments on this, mm-hmm. but we can imagine that if we take a mouse that we vaccinate against Lyme disease, because we have vaccines that work on the mice, mm-hmm. and we sequence the mice that have been vaccinated to figure out how their immune systems have evolved to recognize the Lyme bacteria, mm-hmm. then we might take those evolved genes from the mice and encode it into the mouse genome, the mouse germline, so that future generations of mice are born with that protection.
And if successful, there goes away Lyme disease, but you have now permanently altered the ecosystem, or at least until you decide to switch it back.
But here's the thing. What we just described only works in the mouse in the laboratory. And because that doesn't provide a benefit to the mouse, it will likely not spread in the wild.
Hold that thought. I want to come back and see how that might or might not work. We're talking about editing nature's software. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about editing nature's software, DNA, the emerging, exploding human capacity to rewrite the code, and what that means for the next phase of evolution, human and otherwise. Kevin Esfeldt is my guest, evolutionary biologist and engineer, works on gene drives, fellow at the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard Medical School. He was the first to demonstrate how gene drives, we'll talk about that, and CRISPR could combine to alter the trait of wild populations. He's developed methods of genome editing, regulation, immunization, population level engineering of the code. You can join us this hour. What do you think? If we soon have the power to widely tinker with the very code of life, how shall we use it? Are you prepared to edit DNA to rid the world of Lyme disease, malaria? What about a change in a line of cats or dogs? Or what about to change a line of humans? And Kevin Esfeldt says in 7 generations, with this power, we will have crashed civilization or become like angels. Are you ready for this? A little girl in England, Layla Richards, 1-year-old, had an aggressive form of leukemia. She was cancer-free 3 months after a new treatment performed that edited genes to create immune cells designed to target and kill drug-resistant leukemia. Dr. Paul Vase was Layla's lead doctor at the Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. Here's an interview from last week. He's excited about the success of that treatment. Cautioned they still don't know how well it would work in other patients.
Layla's very tough. She's coped with these treatments. Other children may not be able to do in the same way. These cells appear to have worked incredibly well for her, but that doesn't mean they're going to work for the next 5 or 10 children that we treat, and we need to do some proper studies to learn just how good they are.
But they're in there editing away. Here's Layla's father, Ashley Richards, saying he knew there was a risk, but it was worth it.
I took the gamble, and this is her today, standing, laughing, giggling. She was so weak before this treatment, and this is horrible. It's horrible, and I'm just thankful.
Who cannot be happy to hear a 1-year-old doing so much better, and you hear the relief of her father? Kevin Esfeldt is with me in the studio, and that's just the kind of scene that makes one say, well, come on, if we can do this, let's do this. But the power, this capacity has grown a lot just in the last handful of years and is likely to grow much more widely still. We were talking about the wild, where you've paid a lot of attention, and to gene drives, which I guess, if I understand it, this is the thing that makes it possible for these changes to be heritable, for them to go on and on, not just in one mouse and done, but in whole populations.
Exactly. So normally when we alter an organism, we have to keep in mind that we're altering something that evolution has essentially optimized for survival and reproduction in its ancestral habitat. If you mess with it, then you're almost certainly going to impair its ability to survive and reproduce. But with a gene drive, what we're doing is we insert the CRISPR system for genome editing into the genome along with the change that we want to spread. And that means that whenever that piece of DNA encounters the original version, say in the offspring of that particular mouse, then editing will happen again. So that is the CRISPR system will cut the original version.
It becomes part of the line of descent. This will happen again and again.
Exactly. So every generation, it will cut the original version and replace it with the new version. So that over many generations, going from parents to offspring, the new trait will sweep through the wild population.
How would that work? Let's say you wanted to get rid of Lyme disease in North America. How many mice do you have to put out in the woods with this gene drive installed to change the whole population over what period of time?
So mice reproduce roughly five or so times a year in terms of 5 litters a year, but the generation time – and the generation time is about 2 months.
Okay.
So if you release one mouse per 10,000 mice in the wild, then it would take a minimum of 16 mouse generations.
That's not that long.
Which
That's
is not that long,
year, couple,
which is a few years. Which is why this technology is very powerful if used on organisms that reproduce very quickly. Whereas, of course, in something very long-lived, elephants, whales, humans, you would have to wait 1,000 years or more. So when it comes to potentially fighting disease, then we could potentially use this to immunize the wild mouse population so that ticks are no longer infected with Lyme disease when they bite the mice and then don't pass it on to us anymore.
As we sit here today, how are public health officials looking at this opportunity? This is something that we could do, should not do?
And that's really the question, because it's not up to me to decide whether we should do this. It should not be up to public health officials to decide whether or not we should do this. This needs to be a decision made by the community to decide how we are going to alter the shared environment.
A lot of people are freaked out by Lyme disease, and many suffer from it, and many don't go into the wild because they fear it. So from a human perspective, there's a pretty strong incentive to go with this. How should the community then weigh this? You're hip deep in all this.
Well, there's the question. Bringing it back to the little girl with leukemia, it's a matter of risks and benefits. And right now, I would argue that we don't know enough about the potential risks, because after all, at this point, we're discussing the idea, because when it comes to altering the shared environment, when it comes to a technology that allows a few scientists in a laboratory to potentially affect the lives of so many.
So many mice.
So many mice,
and
but
humans.
Then potentially humans, because the mice are part of the ecosystem out there, and we all rely on healthy ecosystems. So when it comes to deliberately altering them, we have a responsibility to never attempt that without public support.
Evolution has taken millions and millions and millions of years to make a mouse, as we see today. Is it within the realm of possibility for humans to imagine that they could understand the repercussions of a genetic intervention? Or is that simply beyond our capacity and therefore should be out of bounds?
It depends entirely on the genetic intervention. And that's a really important point, which is that the gene drive is just the mechanism of spreading the alteration.
Okay, let's just to do what we need to do to get rid of Lyme disease.
So then in that case, we're taking an immune response that evolved in the mice and we're putting it in all of the mice. So is that going to affect any other species?
I don't know.
Probably not, but we don't know for sure. So how do you find out? Well, one way to do it is we might make a bunch of mice in the lab that are resistant to Lyme but don't have the gene drive. Then imagine that we release a lot of them, say on an island off the coast that normally has Lyme disease, and we monitor that small ecosystem to see how it changes. It does anything unexpected happen? We could do this for several islands. And because there's no gene drive, there's no risk of that trait continuing to spread.
Okay.
And then based on that data,
investigation,
we could then decide, is this something that we want to scale up? Do you want to try a larger island, perhaps an inhabited island? And at what point are you willing to introduce the gene drive to alter a larger population?
Widen the lens here. There's the question around dealing with Lyme disease, and people feel pretty strongly about Lyme disease. What will other more arresting compelling cases for this kind of genetic intervention, rewriting the code, what might they look like? Well, give us some examples of what questions are going to come.
So there's certainly compelling cases in public health abroad as well as here. So you can imagine changing mosquitoes so they can't transmit malaria or dengue. And if that fails, if the pathogens out-evolve us, shall we say, then one option would be to use gene drives to remove the mosquitoes. Similarly, when it comes to ecosystem
people
health.
People have dreamt of that for, I mean, there would be no mosquitoes. You would just, and you wouldn't have to spray with DDT. You would, genetically sign a death warrant for them. Just take them out.
Well, there are 1,400 or so species of mosquitoes in the world, and about 30 of them spread malaria with any kind of efficiency, and really only 5 or 6 really well, and only 2 spread dengue really well. So you're talking 7 to 9 mosquito
species max. It
sounds
manageable, whether or not we should do it. It sounds doable.
It might be. It may well be doable. I mean, I can't make promises because we haven't done it in the laboratory yet. And frankly, when we do it in the laboratory, we have an obligation to tell people what we're planning to do before we do it. Because when you're working with a technology that can affect the shared environment, you have to tell people what might happen and that you're going to do it because in this case, if you screw up, you're affecting the lives of other people, not just people in the laboratory.
And this is why we're speaking here right now today, a kind of early version of this conversation that I imagine we're going to hear a lot more of down the road. So, all right, maybe we're going to take out 7 species of mosquito. What else? What other compelling cases for genetic intervention?
Well, in many cases, invasive species are destroying native ecosystems and driving species extinct, usually because we introduced those invasive species, and now we can't do anything about them.
Talking about Asian carp in the rivers of the Midwest, or I don't know.
Asian carp in the rivers of the Midwest, lionfish in the Atlantic and the Caribbean. Those are just your aquatics. Bringing back to mosquitoes, there were no mosquitoes in Hawaii in the 17th and 18th century.
We
introduced them in the 19th century. We brought mosquitoes to paradise.
So you could make Hawaii mosquito-free again.
We could, and those mosquitoes are actually killing native Hawaiian honeycreepers, beautiful birds that are not at all resistant to bird malaria because there's a malaria for birds as well. And the mosquitoes in Hawaii carry this bird malaria and are killing all of these birds. So the birds only live high up in the forest near the tops of the volcanoes. So the question then becomes, what are we going to do? Because as the planet warms, the birds have less and less habitat every year because the mosquitoes rise higher and higher up. So right now we're anticipating that we're going to lose most of these birds by 2050 if we don't do something.
So tweak the code of nature in the mosquitoes, you might save the birds. So far we're talking about pests and pestilence. Take it beyond that because there are going to be there'll be other compelling cases that aren't based on avoiding pain or pests. What else do you think is going to invite intense attention from those who understand the code of nature?
Well, there's definitely going to be agriculture, but I would like to bring it back to the ecological management, ecological conservation ends. That is, there are a lot of species that maybe are going to face a pressure because we know that, say, a disease is sweeping across the globe. And we anticipate that we will not be able to stop it from reaching particular habitats. Suppose that we know that a particular related species is resistant and we know how. Should we then use a gene drive to protect a species in advance?
Which you could do.
Which we could potentially do.
But pretty soon then, you're engaged, you know, the Colin Powell rule for military intervention was you break it, you own it. Pretty soon you're calling the tune of the nature's genetic code.
Or at least you are trying.
You're trying. But once you get engaged with it, responsibility comes with that.
Absolutely.
And you are changing things once you begin doing that.
And it's an open question as to whether we should do this at all. Again, there are many very compelling instances, Lyme disease, malaria, and so on, saving the Hawaiian birds. There are many cases where we may wish to consider intervening, where there is a compelling case to consider it. That doesn't mean we should do it.
But the pressure is going to be there. There are going to be needs. There are going to be fears. There are going to be, who knows, drought or disease. And the capacity is growing. Kevin Esfeldt is with us. We're talking about editing nature's software, DNA. Let's go to some callers here. Scott in Gaffney, South Carolina. Scott, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thank you for taking the call. So the process of evolution is the path upon which the human race is on. The path leads to a goal, and I was wondering if your guest had given any contemplation to the goal of human evolution. What's the end game? Without getting spiritual, I also, a second question would be, so there are some tremendously beneficial aspects from the proposed project, but if we remove the natural causes of fundamentally population control when currently already experiencing a dearth of resources and refugee problems across the planet, if we expand the lifespan and if we remove all these natural controls, how will that play out? How will that ultimately truly benefit? Has that been contemplated? And I'll take my answers offline. Thank you.
Two big questions. I don't know where you want to dive in first, Kevin, but first, and I guess it's right, once you start intervening, you better understand what is the goal. I mean, do you agree with Scott that evolution has had a goal, or do you simply have to impose one if you begin to intervene?
Well, I must respectfully disagree that evolution does have a goal beyond the imperative to replicate. So I would argue that there is no intrinsic inherent goal to human evolution, or indeed the evolution of any other species, beyond the imperative for our information to replicate one way or another. It is, in many ways, a law of nature, every bit as much as the laws of physics is the law of evolution. And in many ways, capitalism is also a redheaded stepchild of evolution. When you think about it, it is survival of the fittest in the marketplace, even as it is in the wild. But it's also important to realize that evolution has no moral compass.
If humans begin to intervene, do we have to introduce one?
That's a very important question that we need to address. We ended up evolving a moral compass because, as it turned out, that was an effective way for our information to replicate. But there isn't one inherently in the evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, should we impose ours that we have evolved and to some extent designed, figured out perhaps, invented on the rest of reality?
It sounds like going pedal to the metal on the sort of prioritization of human needs over every other species that we've already done quite a lot with without genetic editing.
And there's the question, because to date, our technologies for intervening with nature have been very crude.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine that when we have a problem with an insect attacking our crops, we spray insecticides that kills all of the insects.
Mm-hmm.
And with typically devastating ecological consequences. What if instead we could rewrite that insect's genetic code such that it simply did not like the taste of our crop? Then it could continue to live in the environment. We could grow our crop unmolested. And ideally, no other species would be affected. It's a much more elegant intervention.
It goes right to his second question, though. If you're advantaging life all the time in this way, rather than the sort of grim reaper who has played a role in evolution, what happens to carrying capacity? Do you overwhelm it?
So you can never overwhelm carrying capacity, because if you do, it will crash. But in the case of humans, thankfully, we have abundant evidence that lowering mortality rates, especially infant and child mortality rates, causes families to choose birth control, to choose family planning.
So net.
And so net reduced overall population growth. So, and this has been shown by many organizations, and the Gates Foundation is a leading proponent of this idea. And it's quite well supported that if you can reduce infant and child mortality rates, people will have fewer children, and you will net reduce the total number of humans on the planet. So if you care about sustainability and carrying capacity, then we need to get these diseases under control.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about editing nature's software, DNA, the emerging, exploding human capacity to rewrite the code, and what that means for the next phase of evolution, human and otherwise. And Kevin, we've got the full range of response online here. Kyle says yes to CRISPR, this gene editing technology. G. Welch is thinking about imminent needs. She says, could engineering bacteriophages be the solution to the decreasing effectiveness of antibiotics? We'll look at that. But here, Patty says, holy hubris, Batman. And Brian says, gene drive, this is the craziest and most dangerous thing I've ever heard. Nuclear bombs are toys for kids compared to this. You've got the whole range right there. Let's get our callers in. Los Angeles, Saad is calling. Saad, good to hear from you. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. My comment, and maybe a question as well, is it might be short-term basis that we can see desirable changes when we perform such experiments. But the concern is, if you tinker with the genetic code, you may have some undesirable side effects. But these side effects, or the phenotypic changes, the changes on the human body or the animal body, may take years and years to appear. For example, if we want to do a certain genetic change, and it might take years and years to find out that this has resulted in increased incidence of heart disease or atherosclerosis.
Mm-hmm.
But that might take a long time, many generations, or even several generations, basically, to be able to find out these undesirable effects. So my comment here is that this may not be feasible because the side effects may not be foreseen in the near future. It may take many generations to multiply and reproduce before we can see the undesirable side effects. By then, it may be too late, basically. It may be the doomsday scenario.
Good question. Good point. Let me put it to Kevin.
So that is a great point, and it's a profoundly important cautionary note when it comes to editing future humans and why doing so at this point is premature. That is, we have data on existing variants in the human population, existing genetic variants. And we even have data in a variety of contexts because there are so many people. And as we learn more about the human genome and link people's sequence genomes to health records, we will learn more and more about which variants are good and which ones are bad. But if you're talking about creating something that has never been there before, then we don't know. And all of those points come into play. If you're talking about editing wild populations, then there are similar concerns, but again, we're talking about editing organisms that reproduce fairly quickly. So we should observe what happens for several generations before we consider doing this in the wild. What's more, it's important to note that because we can rewrite wild populations and their DNA, we can also overwrite the effects of a previous change that we've made. So we can't undo the fact that we need a gene drive to do it. So the gene drive CRISPR machinery will be there regardless. But we can overwrite a prior change if it turned out to have undesirable side effects. So one of the things we've called for, and one of the reasons why we went public with what our predictions of what this technology could do before we began experiments in the laboratory, was to call for everyone to build appropriate precautions into their research. That is, if you're building a gene drive that has any chance whatsoever of spreading in the wild, you absolutely must build this reversal drive that would undo whatever that change is. Now, but it's also important, like the caller said, the side effects might not be reversible. And that's true, because even if you change the original genomic change back, if the effects on other species change the ecosystem in a certain way, then even if
it's
you undo
running.
The original change, it may have passed a tipping
There's
point
a wrinkle,
and it may
you
not
batted.
Go back. So that is an excellent reason why we have to be cautious.
Can you lay out some of the other predictions of what this would be capable of doing so we can begin to understand the scale of the issues that are coming toward us?
So right now, most of our to-do list, as it were, in terms of potential applications really are centered around pests, things that spread disease, things that eat our crops, things that upset the balance of natural ecosystems, usually because we introduce them. And in terms of how radical this is, well, what we're proposing to do with a gene drive is to alter a species that is already there, or in some cases to remove it, ideally from a region where it should not have been in the first place, at least, according to the original ecosystem. Contrast that with introducing a new species entirely, whether unintentionally, like we usually do, or sometimes intentionally.
You mean introducing a species to a geography where it hasn't been present before?
That's right. And so ecologists now practice what's called biocontrol. That is, if there is a problem with an invasive species, then they will look at the original habitat for a parasite or a predator
to take it out.
That is ideally exclusive to the problematic species, so then they can consider introducing it to the new environment in order to control the problem. But that's actually a more drastic solution than a gene drive. So you have to consider the scale
of
the alteration.
Take us to some of the other things that are coming here. You talked about in terms of human capacities, in the next just couple of decades, we may be looking at intervening how?
So right now, all of the talk about CRISPR and the human germline is very premature. That is to say, it is not going to be safe enough for quite a few years for anything remotely resembling a designer baby. If you are all concerned about that, you should be looking much more closely at in vitro fertilization, which already allows us to create several dozen embryos, which we can now sequence and selectively implant the one that looks like it has is likely to have the lowest risk of genetic disease or lowest overall mutational load. And that is in many ways more powerful than CRISPR because you can get sort of the best possible combination of you, to quote a certain movie.
So look further down the road. You say it's premature, which gives a sense of inevitability over time. I don't know if that's the right interpretation, but look further down the road.
One of the things that concerns me is that we don't really choose which technologies we develop. That is, the laws of physics and evolution determine what is possible, and the laws of capitalism force us down particular paths. And once we discover a box, we tend to open it. So this CRISPR gene drive box, those choices are going to be imminent right now. That is, I would be surprised if in the next couple of years we do not have CRISPR gene drives capable of addressing many of these problems. And one of the urgent needs is that we start discussing whether or not we should do this. And my preference is that we should discuss this before we even begin the experiments in the laboratory. Because if these projects are to occur, they must be community-owned. They may be enabled by scientists, but they should not be led by scientists.
So pull the curtain back further so we can understand the scope of implications here. When you say in seven generations, we may be like angels or we may have crashed civilization, and you're tying this to this gene editing, to this understanding of nature's software in a way, maybe not entirely, but in some significant portion, what capacities are you imagining could emerge that would either lead to this angelic vision, which I'm still having trouble getting my head around what you mean by that, or the crashed civilization path?
So fortunately, CRISPR gene drives, because they are reversible, make a terrible weapon. That is to say that it's too easy to defend against them because as soon as you detect one in the wild, you know how to build the counter that will overwrite it.
Weapon. Are you talking human weapon? Human against human weapons?
It would be an ecological change. But there's the thing. According to the Biological Weapons Convention, any technology capable of impacting the lives of humans that is biological is in principle a candidate biological weapon. And Article 1 says that you must never develop such a thing in a way that could potentially be used as a weapon.
So in a roundabout way, I asked this question. One of the first things you put on the table is genetic weapons that would alter a whole ecosystem potentially in a kind of in a military sense.
Well, my point is that that is essentially not possible because it is too easy to defend against. It is not a viable route of doing that, and it's consequently not a viable route of crashing civilization.
Okay.
I am worried about new technologies that we have not yet discovered.
Along the gene editing line, in that path of inquiry?
Possibly, and that's just because one of the risks is of a natural pathogen or of humans recreating a natural pathogen. Arguably, the greatest achievement of humanity was eradicating smallpox, except for the samples now kept in hopefully only two laboratories. And hopefully it will stay gone. But the smallpox genome is not that large. And you can imagine that if we get too good at making DNA, then you might give too many people the ability to recreate it. And then we would have to attempt to get rid of it again. But what if they recreate it in a way that is, say, escapes the vaccine? These are things that we need to worry about. And I'm just throwing that out there, not because I think that that is a particularly likely scenario, but that there are many unknowns where we might discover a technology that could turn out to be dangerous in ways that we can't anticipate today.
Well, I mean, that we know, but I had the impression that you were talking about this threat to civilization being based in no small part in the downside potential of the kind of work you're doing if it's not well considered.
I think that the downside potential of this is not so much technical or even ecological risks. The risk is that we as a society will fail to come together to decide what we want the future to look like, how we should interact with the living world. And in not agreeing, that could spark additional conflict between us that could result in other technologies coming into play.
As you say, we tend to open the boxes. And what about on the other side? This, if humans emerge as angels, I asked about that at the top of the hour, and you went sort of toward behavior right away.
Here's the thing.
Is that genetic?
We define ourselves primarily by our conception of morality. Mm-hmm. That is, when we talk about people's lives and how they impacted us, we talk about what sort of person they are. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to various forms of cognitive disease, the only cases in which we say this person is not themselves anymore mm-hmm. is when those areas of the brain that govern morality are damaged. We define people by their sense of morality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the term angels is appropriate because mm-hmm. it connotes greater power. And it's inarguable that if you look at 175 years ago, the capabilities of people then based on technology, if you showed them what we can do today,
mm-hmm.
they would consider those angelic powers.
Mm-hmm.
There is no question of that. So all I am saying with the seven generations mm-hmm. is two things, really. On the current trajectory of advance, especially given our capability to rewrite DNA and process information efficiently, it is not unreasonable to assume that 175 years hence, people will have powers that we would consider angelic.
I also thought I heard you say that our species would be unrecognizable. Do you mean in terms of powers? Again, I took that to mean that we would be manipulating our genetic profile in such a way that would make us potentially unrecognizable.
Here's the thing. We can, and we probably will. At first, to remove as much genetic disease as possible, remove all physical and mental illness. But then you run into a question. What constitutes physical and mental illness? Is it the case that if you remove all physical and mental illness, do those afflict everyone? We all have some degree of what we call mutational load in our genomes. That mm-hmm. is, we all have a scattering of mutations that usually break things, of course, because that's what most mutations do,
mm-hmm.
scattered throughout our genomes that are not present in most other humans. So they're almost certainly deleterious. What if you removed those? What would the resulting person look like? They would be free of physical and mental disease,
mm-hmm.
there is a non-trivial possibility that they would be what we would consider to be superhuman. And again, this is not changing any of the existing DNA. That is, we would not be introducing new sequences that had never previously been found in a human. Just taking away all the weaknesses. What would happen with that? Arguably, some weaknesses, we might say, would be we know that being, say, a sociopath
mm-hmm.
is a heritable trait. That is, there is a heritable mm-hmm. risk. It is a genetic proclivity. Should we choose for future generations to not be sociopaths?
And who's going to choose? I mean, you could argue that no small number of leaders have been sociopaths. Might certain families decide they'd prefer to remain sociopaths while the rest of the population became compliant?
Became compliant and
pacific.
Sheep. It's a potential risk in certain governance structures in certain countries. Now, is that particularly likely to happen? I suggest that, in fact, we're probably going to go the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that there is strength in diversity, and having a number of different viewpoints contributing to a discussion often leads to a better empirical solution
mm-hmm.
than a monoculture.
Mm-hmm.
But if you give people the choice of saying, okay, we can guarantee you the reduced risk of say, autism in your children
mm-hmm.
at the cost of reduced neurodiversity and possibly creativity,
mm-hmm.
people might take that, and the resulting diversity of viewpoints intrinsically based on how people think might be diminished. It's also possible that that would not be the case, that if you removed all the mutational load, then you might keep all of the gifts and just remove the costs.
Can we close this box, walk away, and not have to figure all this out? Or are we going to have to pick up this godlike power and with our feeble minds learn how to use it?
Well, hopefully we can make our minds somewhat less feeble. But my view is that we have never successfully closed a box that we have discovered. We have never closed the lid and stepped back and walked away when that power was remotely useful in any context. What we have managed to do to some extent is to keep the lid only partially cracked so that we can try to pull only useful things out of it. And that's really the challenge. What is the best way to do that? And my assertion is that the best path forwards is to ensure that science is done transparently, that the people have a voice in what science is done, and have access to it as it is ongoing, because science is the light that enables us to see the world clearly. And yet most of it is done in secret. Why should we keep the light that lets us see shuttered in darkness?
We're opening that just a crack here today, a public conversation about what we'll no doubt hear much, much more of in the years to come when it comes to gene editing and much more. Kevin Esvelt from the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard Medical School. Thank you very much for coming in today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.